three knocks, spaced unevenly, the way a person knocks when their hand is shaking too much to do it twice the same. I had been alone in that cabin for 9 days and was not expecting anyone. I crossed to the door with the axe still in my hand, because a man alone in the White Pen Reach in the deep of winter does not open his door empty-handed. I lifted the bar. Cold came in first, white and serious, and then she came in behind it, or rather, she did not come in. She fell forward into the doorway, and I caught her under the arms before her knees finished folding. "I'm sick," she said, with her face turned half against my cloak. "I can't walk. Can I stay one night? I have been a king for 11 years. I have heard 1,000 requests, most of them dressed in long words and longer reasons. None of them ever held me the way that one did. Whatever else I was, woodsman, hunter, the king of a realm she had no idea I owned, the only thing I was when I heard her ask was a door, and the only thing she asked was to be let through it. I said yes before I had decided to. I carried her across the small room, set her on the bench by the fire, and pulled the door shut against the wind. She was not heavy. She was light in the wrong way, the way a person is light when they have been on foot too long and not eaten enough. Her boots were soaked through. Her shawl was thin and not made for the high country. Her hair, dark and loose under her hood, had snow caught in it that had not melted. She tried to thank me, and the word broke apart in her mouth. "Save it," I said, more gently than I sounded. "Sit, I'll see to you." I left the axe by the door, where she could see it if she wanted to. A woman alone in a stranger's house in the dark of winter wants to know where the door is and where the steel is. I wanted her to know both. I knelt at the hearth and built up the fire. I had banked it low for the night. I pushed 3 thick rounds of pine into the bed of coals and they caught at once. Light leapt up the walls. I could see her properly now. She was perhaps 30, perhaps a little less. Her face was thin and her cheekbones flushed with a fever that did not belong to the cold. There was no fear in her eyes, only the slow, careful exhaustion of someone who had walked past the place where being afraid would still help. "What's your name?" I asked. "Ren," she said. "I'm Arden," I said, and I gave her my common name without thinking, the way a man gives his name to a guest. It was not a lie. It was the only name I had grown up answering to. The other one, the one with the title on the front of it, I had carried for 11 years, but I had been Arden first and longer. "Arden," she said. She tasted the word and seemed to find it ordinary, which was what I had wanted. "I'm sorry to come at you in the night." "It's a door," I said. "That's what it's for." I unlatched her boots. They were so soaked that water ran out of them onto the boards. I set them on the hearthstones to dry. Her feet, when I peeled the wool stockings off, were blue-tipped and raw at the heel. I went to the cupboard for the small earthen jar of bear grease salve I kept for winter cuts, and I rubbed it carefully into her heels and the tops of her toes. She did not say a word while I did it. She watched my hands and her eyes were too wet, but she did not cry. I think she was past crying. "I'll boil water," I said. "There's broth. Have you eaten today?" "Yesterday morning," she said, "I think." I had killed a hare 2 days before, and the stock from it was still simmering low at the back of the hearth. I poured a bowl, broke bread into it, and put it in her hands. She held the bowl as if she could not quite trust that it was hers. Her fingers shook against the rim. "Eat slowly," I said. "If you have not eaten in a day, your stomach will not thank you for hurry." She ate slowly. I watched her without watching her. I have spent 11 years learning how to study a room without being seen to study it. I saw the way she held the spoon, the careful smallness of her sips, the long pause she made between mouthfuls as if she had to ask her body each time whether it was still ready to receive food. I saw the seam of her dress, mended 3 times in the same place with 3 different threads. I saw the small leather satchel she had set against the wall, the brass clasp polished to a shine that did not match the worn body of the bag. A working woman's satchel, kept proud. When the bowl was half empty, I took it from her and set it aside. More in an hour, I said. Sleep first. I gave her the cot by the fire. It was where I slept. I would take the floor by the door for the night, which suited me, because if anyone else came through that storm, I wanted to be the one between them and her. I gave her my own blanket, the heavy one of gray wool, and the fur cloak I had hung on its hook by the lintel. She tried to refuse the cloak. I put it over her anyway and tucked it under her chin the way a man tucks in a child, and she closed her eyes and was asleep before I had pulled the second corner over her feet. I sat for a long while on the floor with my back to the door and watched her breathe. The wind out beyond the shutters was loud the way the wind always is in the White Pine Reach in midwinter, a continuous high hard sound that you stop hearing after a day or two, but that does not stop. I had not heard it for 9 days the way you do not hear a clock you live with. I heard it now. I heard it because something else, inside the room, had gone quieter. I did not have a name for that quieter thing then. I would, in time. For the moment I only sat with my hand on my knee and watched the rise and fall of her breath under the gray wool, and felt, for the first time in I could not remember how long, that I did not want the morning to come and take her away. I should explain why I was there alone in a hunter's cabin in midwinter, with no guard, no banner, no horse but the rough roan I had ridden up on, and no one in the world but my chief steward who knew where I was. It is an old practice in my line. Once each winter, before the deepest cold, the King of Hymir goes out alone and walks the far reach for a fortnight as a common man. No retinue, no crest, no name but the one his mother gave him. He sleeps where there is room and asks for bread the way a traveler asks. He listens to what people say of their lord when they do not know their lord is listening. He carries an axe, not a sword. He comes home before the first thaw. My grandfather kept this practice, and so did my father, and I have kept it for 11 years now. I keep it for the listening, but also for the air. There is a thing that happens to a man who is bowed to for too many days in a row. It gets in his shoulders and stays there. The reach takes it out of me. I come back able to bend down to my own boots again. This year I had gone deeper than usual. I had taken the trail up past the falls into the White Pine, where almost no one keeps a holding, and I had stayed in this small cabin, which belonged to a forester named Hess, who let me have it for a season's worth of firewood, because I wanted to be where no one would come asking. The council in Hymir had spent the autumn pressing me to take a wife. The high houses sent letters with their daughters' miniatures painted in the margins. The southern realms sent envoys with veiled offers and unveiled marriage portions. I had said no to every one of them with the kind of polite refusal that is harder to keep saying than to mean, and I had come up the mountain partly to stop having to. I had told my steward 2 weeks, no longer. I would walk down to Hess's croft at the new moon, send word that I was safe, and walk up again. Otherwise, I was to be left alone. I had not expected anyone to come up the mountain after me. I had not expected the door to open and let her in. By the second day, her fever had broken. I knew it would. She had not been sick from anything mortal, only the long cold and the long walk and the empty belly piled together. A night of warm broth and warm wool will mend that in a strong body, and her body, for all its lightness, was strong. By the morning of the second day, she was sitting up under the cloak and asking for water, and by the noon meal, she was able to put her feet on the boards and stand. She tried to leave that afternoon. I had gone out to split wood, partly because the woodpile wanted it, and partly because I needed to be out of the cabin for an hour to find my thinking. And when I came back, she had folded my cloak on the cot, gathered her satchel, and was sitting on the bench by the fire with her boots on her feet. "Don't," I said, before I knew I was going to. She looked up. There was a small, careful smile on her mouth that I would learn to know. It was the smile of a woman who has practiced being light to be carried, who has practiced staying not long. "You've been very kind," she said. "I would not impose another night." "You can't walk." "I can walk." "You can stand," I said. "There is a difference. The trail down is 6 miles of ice. You'd be on your knees inside an hour. She did not answer that, because it was true and we both knew it. I set the wood I had brought in down beside the hearth and brushed snow off my shoulders. I did not look at her directly. I had spent 2 days learning that looking at her directly made her feel observed in a way she did not yet trust. "Stay until you can walk it without stopping," I said. "That's not a kindness, it's just sense. If you start down ill, I'll have to go down after you, and I don't fancy the trail in the dark." "That is a kindness," she said, "with sense laid over the top of it. Don't dress it up." I laughed. I had not laughed in a fortnight. The sound was unfamiliar in the room. "All right," I said. "It's a kindness. Stay anyway." She stayed. By the fourth day, I knew her story, because by the fourth day she had decided I had earned it. She had been the midwife of a village called Lomir, 2 valleys south, for 9 years. She had come there at 21, apprenticed under an old woman named Senna who had died in the 3rd year and left Ren her cottage, her herbs, her 3 carved birthing stools, and her name on the village register. Ren had attended 142 births in those 9 years. She had lost 3 mothers and 7 children, which was a record any midwife in the Southern Pax would have been proud to keep. She had not been paid in coin most years. She had been paid in eggs and in butter, and in the right to take a chicken from a yard when she needed one. In the autumn, a new lord had taken Lomir. The old lord had died of a long sickness, and a younger cousin had ridden in with his retinue and his banners and his own people. Among his own people was a healer named Brenna, from the eastern coast, who had been his mother's woman before him, and would be his pack's woman now. Brenna had the new lord's ear. Brenna told the new lord that the village of Lomir did not need 2 healers in a place that small, and that the established one, Ren, was a holdover from the previous lord's day, and that she had been seen reading from books no proper midwife should read from, by which Brenna meant the herbalist's book Senna had left, which any village healer worth her bones would have kept open at her elbow. The new lord, who did not know Ren and had no quarrel with her and had no time for the matter, signed an order moving her out of Senna's cottage and into the back rooms of the village inn, and gave the cottage to Brenna. Ren had moved to the inn for 1 week. At the end of that week, the innkeeper, whose wife had been delivered by Ren of all 4 of her children, had come to her in the night and told her, half ashamed, half furious, that the new lord's man had told him that Ren was not to attend any birth in the village henceforth, by order of the new healer. Brenna would attend the births. Ren could keep the inn room and might be permitted to wash linens. Ren had thanked the innkeeper for his kindness. She had packed her satchel, her birthing knife, her bone needle, her 3 carved stools she could carry, her 7 cloth-wrapped jars of crushed herb, the small ledger of her 142 births, and she had walked out of Lomir the next morning before first light, because she did not want any of the women who had loved her to see her go. She had been walking for 5 weeks when she came to my door. She told me all of this in the way a woman tells a thing she has stopped hoping anyone will be angry on her behalf about. Steadily, with the bones of it intact, not dressed up, she told it as a fact about her life, the way another woman would tell where she had been born. I sat across from her, at the small table, with my hands folded together to keep them still. "Where were you going?" I asked. She thought about that. "There is a village over the second pass called Marrowburn," she said. "They lost their midwife in the summer to a winter that came early. I was hoping I would still be welcome there." "Marrowburn is a hard ride from here in spring," I said. "In winter, on foot, it isn't a ride. It's a death." "I had not thought it through that far," she said. "Past Lomir, only the road." I looked at my folded hands and did not let myself say what I wanted to say, which was that the new lord of Lomir had a name, and that the name was now in my memory in a place from which I do not let names easily fall. The lords of my realm answer to me. I had given them their authority and I could take it back, and I was deciding, very quietly and very carefully across that small table, that I was going to. But I did not say any of that. I said, "Stay until spring." She looked up. "There is no village over the second pass that needs you more than this cabin does," I said. "It needs sweeping. It needs the windows mended. The wood needs splitting and stacking, which is 2 months' work for one man. I'm here through the new moon, and then I have business that will keep me from the mountain until the thaw, and I do not want to leave the place to the snow. Stay through. Help me see it through the winter. I'll pay you in food and firewood and a bed by the hearth. And it's spring. You can walk to Marrowburn warm and rested, and I'll ride down beside you as far as the second pass." She did not answer for a long time. "You don't owe me a roof, Arden," she said at last. "I'm not paying a debt," I said. "I'm offering work, take it or don't." She watched my face. I let her. There was nothing on it I could hide from her and nothing I wanted to. "All right," she said, "through the winter." I did not let my breath out where she could see me do it. By the second week, she had mended my windows. By the third, she had reorganized the cupboards, which I had not known wanted reorganizing until she did it. By the fourth, she had begun a small herb line along the south wall of the cabin, where the sun came in strongest, transplanting the few dried roots she had carried in her satchel into pots made from the bottoms of broken jars. She sang while she worked. She did not know I knew it. She sang the way a person sings when they have stopped expecting anyone to be listening, half-voice, half-tuned, a low, careful thread of melody that ran along under her breath as she ground a paste or carded a strand of wool. Sometimes it was a song I half-recognized, a South Country lullaby, a harvest air. Sometimes it was no song at all, just her breath finding its way to a note and staying there. I made a habit of being on the side of the cabin where I could hear her. I made a habit of bringing in firewood I did not strictly need to bring in. I made a habit of finding small tasks at the workbench while she worked at the hearth, and of asking her once, twice in a day to name a herb for me or tell me what the 7 jars in her satchel were and what each was for. She named them readily: mugwort, yarrow, comfrey root ground, lady's mantle, a pale dried flower she called moondrop that I had not heard the name of before, 2 kinds of bark. She asked nothing of me. She did not ask where I came from. She did not ask why a man alone, my age, had a cabin and an axe and no wife and no children. She did not ask the question that would have walked the easiest into trouble, which was what I did when I was not on this mountain. She simply moved through the days at my side, with the careful, unimposing presence of a person who had spent her whole working life in other people's houses. On the 8th day after her fever broke, I was splitting wood by the lean-to, and I caught my left hand badly with the axe. It was my own fool fault. The rounds were green, harder to read, and one had a twist in it I had not seen. I split it true through the heart, but the recoil drove the haft of the axe up and the head of it down, and the corner of the blade laid open the meat between my thumb and forefinger. I cursed, quietly, because I had been raised not to curse aloud, and stupidly, because if I had cursed loudly, she would not have heard me say the smaller, filthier word under my breath. She came around the corner of the lean-to, as I was clamping my right hand over my left. "Show me," she said. It was the first time I had heard her speak in that voice, the working voice, the midwife's voice, steady, not asking. I showed her. She did not flinch. She took my hand in both of hers and turned it to the light. She said, "Walk to the cabin, don't lift it, don't squeeze, walk." I walked. She walked beside me with one hand under my elbow because I had begun, embarrassingly, to feel faint, which was less from the wound than from the way she had not been startled by it. At the cabin, she sat me down on the bench by the fire, laid a clean linen across my knee under the bleeding hand, opened her satchel, and went to work. She used the comfrey paste and the yarrow leaf. She used a bone needle and 3 small careful stitches. She talked to me the whole time, low and even, not about anything in particular, about how the sun had moved that morning across the herb line, about how the snow had a crust on it now that meant the wind had turned south in the night. Her hands did not shake. Her hands knew exactly what they were doing. When she had finished, she wrapped the hand in clean cloth and tied it off, and she sat back on her heels and looked up at me, and only then did I see, properly, for the first time, what her face looked like in afternoon light with her hair down out of her hood. She had been my guest for 3 weeks. I had not let myself look at her like that before. It would have been the easiest thing in the world, in that moment, to lean forward. I did not. I said, "Thank you, Ren." "You're welcome," she said very quietly. She got up and went to the workbench and began to clean the bone needle, and I sat with my wrapped hand on my knee and listened to the wind out beyond the shutters and noticed, as I had been noticing for some days now, that it did not sound as loud as it had used to. That was the bond. I know that now. It was not a fire in the chest, the way the old songs put it. It was not a strike of recognition that took my breath. It was quieter than any of those. The wind had been at my back for 11 years, and I had not known how much of it I was hearing until her breath, 3 rooms from me, made the room itself a little stiller. The bond came in not as a sound, but as a silence laid down underneath everything else. It came in the way snow comes down, not all at once, but until you look up one morning and the world is white, and you cannot remember the last shape of it before. I sat there with my hand on my knee, and I knew, the way a man knows a thing he has not yet said to himself, that I would not be riding down the mountain alone at the thaw. I would not be riding down at all if it cost me her. On the night after my hand was stitched, she fell asleep on the bench by the fire while I was on the other side of the room, mending a strap of harness. She had pulled her knees up and laid her cheek against the wool of her shawl, and the firelight was on her hair, and she breathed in the long, even way of a person who has not been afraid for several weeks running. I sat with the harness in my lap and did not move. I should have got up and put the gray blanket over her. I should have banked the fire. I should have done a dozen things. Instead, I sat with the leather across my knee and watched her breathe and thought, with the slow, careful astonishment of a man who has not let himself think a thing until it has come, that I had been brought to this cabin by the practice of my house, and she had been brought to this cabin by the cruelty of a small new lord, and the two of us were here, on the same night, in the same one room, because we were meant to be. I do not believe in many things that cannot be proved. I am a king of a hard country, and I make my decisions with my eyes open, but I believe in the bond. I have seen it in my own house, my grandfather and grandmother, who came to one another along a road as strange as ours and stayed together for 51 years, my uncle and his wife, who had to cross a war to find each other, my own parents, who had been promised to each other in childhood and turned out, when they grew, to have been promised by the moon as well as by the council. I believe in the bond because my line has been carried on it. I had not felt it before that winter. I had thought, in the way young men think, that perhaps it was not for me, that I would marry sensibly when the council pressed hard enough, and I would be a good husband, and the bond would be a story I told my children about my grandparents. I had made peace with that, mostly. I had been wrong. I watched her breathe, and I knew I had been wrong, and I knew also, with a clarity that came up under my ribs like cold water, that she did not know any of this. She did not know me. She did not know my name. She did not know the bond was on her, too. She had taken work for the winter from a kind man in a cabin, and she had not been given even the truth of who he was. That saddened me badly. I got up, finally, and laid the gray blanket over her and tucked it under her chin the way I had on the first night, and I went out into the cold to stand on the porch and look at the stars over the white pine. I stood there a long time. When I came back and I had decided, I would tell her. I would tell her the truth before the truth came up the mountain after me, because the truth was going to come up the mountain after me. I had told my steward 2 weeks and we were nearly 6 in, and any day now a rider would come. My steward was patient but not infinite. I would tell her before the rider came. I would tell her in the morning over the porridge plainly, and I would offer her the choice that she had a right to, stay or go, and either one with my full hand behind it. I went to bed certain. The rider came in the morning before the porridge. It was very early. The sun was an hour from rising. I was on the porch splitting kindling for the day's fire when I heard the hoofbeats on the trail below. A tired horse pushed hard at the end of a long ride. I knew that sound. I had heard it 1,000 times in my own courtyard. I set the kindling down very slowly. He came up around the bend and into the clearing and reined in. It was Tomas, one of my own pack runners, a young man of 19 who had served me 3 years and who would have ridden into a wall on my order. He had snow caked to his eyebrows. His horse was lathered. He swung down before the horse had quite stopped, his eyes on me, his face splitting open with the relief of having found me. "My king," he said. He went down on one knee on the trampled snow. I did not look at the cabin door. I did not have to. Tomas had not seen her. He was looking at me. He had a sealed letter in his glove, and he was holding it out to me, and he was saying, too fast, too relieved, that the steward had grown anxious when there had been no word at the new moon, that there was a matter the council needed me for, that the Lord of Lomir had been making trouble in the south, and the steward thought I would want to hear of it directly. He was saying all of this with his head still bowed. I was watching the cabin door over the top of his head. It was open a hand's breadth. I could not see her, but I could see the shape of the morning light against the inside of the threshold and the place where her shadow had passed through it. I let him finish. I took the letter. I told him quietly that he had ridden well, that he was to put his horse in the lean-to and rub it down and come inside for food, but not yet, not for half an hour, because there was something I needed to see to first. He looked up at me. He saw something in my face that he understood as a king's order without my having to put it into one. He said, "Yes, my king," and led his horse around the corner of the cabin, and I stood alone in the clearing with the letter in my hand and the door of the cabin standing a hand's breadth open. I walked to the door. She was standing at the hearth. She had a wooden spoon in her hand. She had not stirred whatever was in the pot. She was looking at the door. I closed it behind me. She did not speak. She did not move. She stood at the hearth with the spoon in her hand and looked at me across the room, and the morning light through the shutters was on her face, and I saw, with a clarity I will carry to the end of my life, that she had heard everything. "Ren," I said. She set the spoon down on the lip of the pot, carefully, deliberately, the way a woman sets a thing down when she is making sure her hands do not throw it. "My king," she said. It was a question and a statement and a small, terrible courtesy altogether. It came out flat. It came out the way a person speaks when they have spent 5 weeks being very careful not to break. "Don't call me that," I said, "please." "What should I call you?" she said, "now." I came across the room. I came slowly, with my hands open at my sides where she could see them, and I stopped 2 paces from her. "Arden," I said, "I told you my name on the first night. I told you the name my mother gave me. I have never been called anything else by anyone who knew me as a child." "And by the people of your kingdom?" "By the people of my kingdom I am called King Arden of Hymir," I said. "I am the 11th of my name. I came up this mountain alone 3 weeks ago because once each winter the King of Hymir walks the reach as a common man. It is an old practice in my line. I did not lie to you about who I was. I told you my name and I did not tell you my rank. That is not the same thing as a lie, but I will not pretend it is the same thing as the truth either. I was going to tell you this morning before the porridge. The rider came first. I am sorry, Ren. I am sorry." She listened to all of it without moving. Her face did not change. The flush of the fire was on one side of it and the cold gray of the morning on the other. When I had stopped speaking, she took the spoon back off the lip of the pot and held it carefully in her hand, the way you hold a thing that is going to be useful later, and she turned her shoulders half away from me toward the hearth. "I should leave," she said. "No," I said. "I should leave today," she said, as if she had not heard me. Before the rider goes back, he will say he found you alone. I will not be in the way of anything. She bent and picked up her satchel from where it sat against the leg of the bench. She straightened. She turned to face me with the satchel in one hand and the spoon in the other, and she looked at me, and her eyes were too bright, and her chin was steady the way I had seen it that first night when she had not cried and had not been going to. "Ren," I said. I went down on one knee. I did it slowly, because I did not want her to think I was performing a thing. I went down on one knee on the boards of the cabin with my hand still wrapped from where she had stitched it 8 days before, and I set the letter from my steward on the floor beside me, and I looked up at her. "I have no claim on you," I said. "I would not have one without your choice. If you want to walk down the mountain today, I will saddle the horses and ride beside you to the second pass and farther if you ask. If you want to walk down alone, I will give you Tomas's horse and a purse and let you go where you mean to go. If you want to stay through the winter as we agreed, I will be your woodsman and nothing more, and I will be glad of every day of it. And if..." I stopped. I made myself say it. "And if you want to stay as more than that, then I will marry you in the spring at Hymir with my whole council standing behind it and the pack at my back and the country told. But that is your word to say, not mine. I did not tell you who I was, and I am not now going to pretend I have earned anything by it. Tell me what you want to do, Ren, and that is what we will do." She did not answer right away. She set the spoon down on the bench very gently. She set the satchel on the boards. She looked at me on one knee on the floor of the cabin she had been sleeping in for 4 weeks, and her face, slowly, the way a thing comes apart that has been held too tight too long, went unstill. "You knelt," she said.
"Yes."
"You should not kneel," she said. "You are the king." "I am the man who let you in at the door," I said. "The rest will come later." She was crying quietly, the way she did everything. The tears went down her face and she did not wipe them. She lifted her hand, the hand that had stitched mine, and she put it slowly on my shoulder. She left it there. "I had chosen already," she said. I closed my eyes for a moment. I had to.
"When?"
I asked. "The third day," she said. "When you brought the broth in twice without my asking and you set my boots on the hearthstones and you did not," her voice broke very softly. "You did not look at me the way men look at women who have nowhere to be. You looked at me the way I had hoped once that a man might look at me. I had chosen by the fourth day. I told myself I was foolish and I made myself stop, because you were going to send me on to Marrowburn at the thaw and I would have had to mend a heart again. But I had chosen."
"You did not know me," I said.
"I knew enough," she said. "I knew the door, I knew the hands. I knew the bear grease on my heels and the cloak on my chin, and the wood you brought in that you did not need. I did not know your name had a king on the front of it. I do not think I needed to." I took her hand off my shoulder and I held it in both of mine. I held it the way you hold a thing you are afraid you will drop. I turned it palm up. That was when I saw the mark. It was rising on the inside of her wrist. It came up slowly the way ink comes up through paper from the underside, first a faint shadow, then a curve, then a circle, then the small radiant lines of a moon at quarter. It was the same mark that was rising, at that very moment, on the inside of my own wrist under the cloth of her stitching. She drew a soft breath. She had felt it before she had seen it. She turned my wrapped hand over in hers, and she undid the cloth 3 turns, 4, and there it was, the same mark, the same moon, the same fine radiant lines. The cut beneath was almost closed. She put her wrist beside mine. The two marks faced each other across the small space between our hands.
"Oh," she said.
She did not say anything else for a long time. Neither did I. The fire moved behind us. Outside, somewhere beyond the lean-to, I could hear Tomas talking quietly to his horse, the way a young man talks to a horse he loves. He did not know yet what had happened in the room behind him. He would learn soon enough.
"Did you know?" she said at last.
"I felt something," I said. I did not know it was the bond. I have never had the bond before. For some days now I have known the wind was quieter when you were in the room. I did not know what that was. I was afraid to know.
Afraid.
Afraid that if I named it you would feel pressed to feel it too. The bond is in my house. It is in the blood of my line, and I have known men who told a woman of it before she had had a chance to feel it for herself, and I have seen the woman bend her heart to fit the news. I did not want to be the man who made you bend. I wanted you to choose me before you ever knew there was anything to choose. She looked down at our two wrists side by side.
I did, she said.
We rode down the mountain at the next thaw. I sent Tomas down ahead with the letter to my steward and one of my own, a letter saying that I was alive and well, that I would be home in 9 days, and that I was bringing my Luna with me. I did not tell my steward more. I would tell my steward more when I was looking at him. We did not hurry. We had 3 weeks together in that cabin after the morning Tomas came, 3 weeks of small, honest days in which I did not have to keep a secret from her any longer, and in which she did not have to learn me again, because she had already learned me as a man before she learned me as anything else. We mended the windows again where the spring wind had loosened them. We finished the woodpile. We packed her 7 cloth-wrapped jars of herb very carefully into the satchel for the ride down. She left the 3 carved birthing stools in the cabin against the south wall, because I told her, and I meant it, that we would be back. The cabin would be ours. The reach was where it had started. The reach was where, every winter going forward, the two of us would come back together for a fortnight alone, the way the kings of my line went out alone before us. On the last morning, I led the roan out of the lean-to and saddled him, and the second horse, Tomas, had left his behind for her, on my order, and I gave her my cloak, because it was still cold on the trail and her shawl, even after a winter of mending, was still too thin. She would not take the cloak at first. She said it was the king's cloak, and she was not yet the king's wife. I said, "You are the king's wife. You are not yet the king's bride. There is a difference. Wear it." She wore it. We came down through the white pine and across the upper trail to Hess's croft, where I sent a message ahead by the forester's son. We came down through the lower forest to the high road. By the time we reached the high road, the country knew. Word had run ahead of us the way word does in the realm. Tomas had reached Hymir 4 days before us, and the steward had told the council, and the council had told the great hall, and the great hall had told the city. And by the time my Luna and I came over the last rise above Hymir, the bells were ringing. She drew her horse up beside mine on the rise and looked down at the city.
Arden, she said.
She had not used the other name once since the morning in the cabin. She had used my own. She said it now, quietly, as a person speaks to steady themselves.
That is a great deal of city, she said.
It is, I said. It will not eat you.
You are quite sure.
I am quite sure, I said. And if any of it tries, I will be standing in front of you, which is what a man at the door does. She looked at me for a moment. She laughed a small, low, honest laugh, and she put her hand on the pommel of her saddle and squared her shoulders, and we rode down into Hymir together with my cloak around her and the spring sun on her hair. The council met that evening. I did not call it formally. I sent word that I would be in the great hall after the supper bell and that any counselor who wished to speak with me before the night was over might come. They all came. There were 9 of them. 4 of them had spent the autumn pressing me to take a foreign princess. 2 had been more careful, urging only that I take a wife of any house at all. 1 had wanted me to make a long betrothal of it. 2 had said nothing and waited to see. They came into the hall in their council blue and they bowed. And they looked, very carefully, at the woman seated in the smaller chair beside mine on the dais, not on the throne, because she had asked me not to put her on it before the wedding, and I had honored that. She wore a plain gown of gray wool that the steward's wife had pressed for her. Her hair was down on her shoulders. She had her hands folded in her lap,
and her chin steady the way I had seen it on the first night in the doorway. I stood. I told the council plainly who she was. I told them her name and the village she had served for 9 years. I told them what had been done to her there. I named the new lord of Lomir and what I intended to do about him, which was not to remove him for the indignity to her, but to call him to Hymir on a matter of the village register, and to make him answer for replacing a midwife who had served the women of Lomir through 142 births. I told them that the woman seated beside me was the mate the moon had given me, and that I would marry her at the next full moon, with their blessing or without it, and that I would prefer their blessing because she deserved a clean welcome. I sat down. There was a silence, not a hostile one, the kind of silence that comes when 9 men have to rearrange a great many sentences they had prepared on the way over. The eldest of them, Lord Vime, who had served my father before me, and was the only one of them who could without insult disagree with me to my face, rose. He bowed to her first, not to me. "My lady," he said. She inclined her head. She did not stand. She did not need to. "I have been a counselor of Hymir for 31 years, he said. "I have advised 3 kings. I told this one in the autumn that he should marry a foreign princess for an alliance with the southern coasts. I will say now that I was wrong, and that I am glad the king did not take my advice, because the moon had better counsel for him than I did." He paused. He looked at her, not in a way that pried, simply in a way that saw. "Be welcome in Hymir, my lady. Be at your ease. I will tell you what I told this king's father on the day his Luna came home. This house is yours. Order it as you will." He bowed again and sat down. The other 8 rose one by one and bowed. 2 of them, the 2 who had been loudest in the autumn, bowed lower than the others, in a way that admitted what they had been wrong about. Ren met every one of them with her chin steady and her hands folded in her lap. She did not smile, and she did not stiffen. She accepted what they offered because it was offered honestly, and she did not pretend it was easy. When the last of them had bowed and the hall was beginning to empty, she leaned a little toward me in her chair. "Arden," she said very low. "Yes. This is going to take getting used to." "It is," I said. "We have time, we have a great deal of time." She nodded. She looked down at her hands. After a moment she looked up at me again, and she smiled, the small private smile she had used in the cabin, the one I had begun to think of as mine. "Take me home," she said. "I would like to sit by your fire." "It's our fire," I said, "but yes." "Let's go." We married at the full moon in the high hall of Hymir, in front of the council and the city and the pack and the priests of the moon. She wore a gown the seamstresses of Hymir had spent 3 weeks on pale silver, modest, with a high collar against the spring chill, and the mark on her wrist plain to be seen. I wore the heavy embroidered cloak of my house. We spoke our words to one another in front of the moon priest in the way of my line. We did not need them, but it pleased me to say them in front of the city, and it pleased her to say them in front of me. The Lord of Lomir arrived in Hymir 2 days after the wedding. He had been called on a matter of the village register, and he had come because a lord does not refuse such a summons. He stood in the smaller council chamber with his hat in his hand. He had not been told whom he was about to face. He learned, when I came in with my Luna at my side, and her wrist turned slightly so the mark could be seen plain, exactly the size of the matter he had stepped into. I did not take his lordship from him. I did not need to. I told him 3 things. First, that the post of midwife in Lomir was returned to Ren's hand to confer as she saw fit, and that she had named a young apprentice from Ren's old register who had been Senna's last student, a girl Ren trusted entirely, to take the seat. Second, that any healer the lord wished to retain for his household was his own concern, but that the village register and the village healer's post would not be his to fill again without consultation with my Luna, who knew that work better than he ever would. Third, that he would, before he rode home, walk to the door of Wren's old cottage and tell the woman now living there that the cottage was to be vacated within the month, so that the new village midwife could take it, and that he would do it himself and with his own mouth, because the order to take it had been his, and the order to give it back was now his too. He looked briefly, as if he might argue. He looked at my Luna. He bowed and went out, and he rode back to Lomir and did exactly what I had told him to do. A month later, a letter came up the south road in a thin, nervous hand. It was from the apprentice, the girl Wren had named Senna's last student, a girl called Pell. Pell wrote that she had moved into the cottage. She wrote that on her second night, a man had walked 3 miles in the rain to fetch her to a labor, and on her seventh night, a woman had brought her 4 eggs and a cloth in payment for sitting up with a child whose fever Pell had walked down by morning. She wrote that the inn was full of women who had asked, very carefully, whether Wren had been treated kindly in the north. She wrote that she was afraid she would be no good at it. She wrote that she had Senna's books on the high shelf and Wren's old ledger on the low shelf, and she opened both every day, and she would try to be worthy of the names in them. Wren read the letter twice. She folded it. She sat for a long while at the window of our chamber with the letter in her lap and her hand on the glass. "I am not angry anymore," she said after a long quiet. "I did not know I had been. I was only walking. But I had carried it the whole way up the mountain, and I had carried it into your hall, and I had been carrying it into this room, and it is gone now, Arden. They are loved. The women of Lomir are loved by a girl I taught. That was the last thing I needed." I did not say anything. I sat down on the seat beside her and put my arm along the back of it and let her lean into my shoulder. And she did. And we sat like that for a long time while the spring sun moved across the floor of our room. She wrote back to Pell that night. "There is a thing I want to set down before I end this telling, because it is the part I think about more often than any of the rest. It is not the wedding. It is not the council bowing to her. It is not the Lord of Lomir walking up the path to that cottage with his hat in his hand. It is not even the morning Tomas came up the mountain, and I went down on one knee on the boards of the cabin and asked her to choose. It is one night, the next winter, in our own first winter back at the cabin in the White Pine. We were 3 days into a fortnight together up there. We had ridden up at the first hard cold of the year, the way we had agreed we would, once each winter, just the two of us, no retinue, the king and his Luna as a man and a woman in a hunter's hold. She had been chopping herbs at the workbench, and I had been mending a strap of harness by the fire. The fire was low. The wind out beyond the shutters was loud. There were 3 knocks at the door. She lifted her head. I lifted mine. We looked at each other across the small room. I set the harness down. I crossed to the door. I did not pick up the axe. I had been a king long enough by then to know when the axe was not the point, and I lifted the bar and opened the door. It was a man. He was perhaps 50, perhaps a little more. He was wet to the knees, and his beard had ice in it. He had walked, by the look of him, a long way through a hard cold. He was holding his hat in one hand. "My name is Hedick," he said. "I'm a tinker from the South Road. I lost my mule in the pass. I'm sick and I can't walk. Can I stay one night?" I did not answer him, not at once. I looked at her across the room. She was already setting down the herbs. She was already pulling the gray blanket off the back of the bench. She was already nodding to me, not because I needed her permission, but because we had built, in the year since she had stood at this hearth with a spoon in her hand and learned who I was, a small clear understanding of how doors worked in our house. I turned back to Hedick the tinker. I stepped aside. "Come in," I said. "Sit by the fire. My wife will see to you." She did. She set him on the bench. She took his wet boots off his feet. She set them on the hearthstones to dry. She gave him broth from the pot and bread broken into it, and the gray blanket over his shoulders and the cot, our cot, to sleep on for the night, while she and I made our bed by the door. In the morning she had his fever down. By the afternoon he could walk. By the second morning we sent him on his way with food for 3 days, a new pair of dry stockings, and a note in my hand to the next holding down the road, asking the holder to give him a mule on Hymir's purse and to send the bill to me. When he had gone, she came back into the cabin and shut the door and stood with her back against it. "That was the same knock," she said. "It was," I said. "Was that on purpose?" "No," I said. "It was the world doing what it does. It comes to the door. Other people come to other doors. They come to ours." She crossed the room. She put her hand on my chest, over the place where the cloak sat heavy on my shoulder. "I would never have come into your hall," she said, "if you had not opened the door first." "You would have," I said. "You would have been somewhere. You would have been Marrowburn's midwife, and 100 more births would have your name in the register, and you would have come into a hall somewhere because the moon meant you to. You would not have come into mine." "No," she said, "not yours." She put her forehead against my collarbone. I put my hand on the back of her head. "I would have spent my whole life listening to the wind," I said, "and not knowing what was loud about it. That is the part I think about, not the council, not the wedding, not the mark on our wrists, not the lord with his hat in his hand on the path, the knock, the door, the hand of a woman I did not know reaching for the latch of my house from the other side, and the breath I drew and the word I said, yes. There are kings of my line who will tell this story when I am gone. They will tell it as the story of how Arden, the 11th of his name, married a midwife from a village called Lomir who came to his door in a blizzard and did not know him. They will tell it because it is a good story. They will tell it because my children will tell it to their children. They will tell it, I hope, with one detail kept whole, the detail I would have them keep above the wedding and above the council and above the moon mark on our wrists." When she asked, "Can I stay one night?" I said yes before I had decided to. That is the line. That is the part of it that mattered. Everything else came after.